It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to a new report published every 2 years, the Living Planet Index. It paints a grim picture of the condition of the planet, but still finds hope for change. And the report acts as a springboard for action to reverse the alarming decline of wild animals. For monitored wildlife populations between 1970 and 2018, it found a 69% decline. 69%. Join in on tracking the health of nature for over almost 50 years. 800-642-1234. Jeff Opperman is global freshwater lead scientist for the World Wildlife Fund, who has worked on the organization's Living Planet Report since 2018. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks so much for having me here to talk about this really important finding and what we can do about it.
Yes, I was just taken aback by the level of detailed data gathering in this report. More than a million hours of computer time on the mapping analysis alone over decades. If you wouldn't mind stepping back to look at the macro for a moment, what is the take-home message of this report?
So the take-home message is that populations of wildlife are declining around the world and have generally been declining since 1970. As you mentioned, the overall decline is 69%. And so that's more than two-thirds decline in the size of these monitored populations in one lifetime or less than a lifetime. 1970, that's I was born in 1971. So in my lifetime.
In the same camp.
Yeah. And just to be clear, you know, what we're talking about is a population that is being monitored. So a population is a group of animals that are in a species that interact and reproduce with each other. So if you think about whale sharks that live in the Indian Ocean and whale sharks that live in the Caribbean, those are both whale sharks, but those are different populations because they're each population is breeding, you know, with each other. And if that population was being monitored over time, then that can go into the Living Planet Index. And the Living Planet Index is a bit like a stock index that's tracking the overall health of wildlife on the planet. The way a stock index has thousands, potentially, like the Dow Jones has, you know, hundreds or thousands of stocks, and some might be going up and some might be going down, but it boils it down to a number that reflects the overall health of the economy. And that's what the Living Planet Index is doing for wildlife.
That analogy helps so much. And I really appreciate that because, you know, you could like try to come to this conclusion that the planet has lost 69% of wildlife since 1970. And that's not the case.
Right, right. So it's not that 70% of all animals have disappeared. It's when you monitor these populations and you're looking at the average health of these populations in a way to summarize that. So there may be some very common species like house sparrows or pigeons or starlings, and they may still be flying around the world in their hundreds of millions. So there's still a lot of animals moving around, and white-tailed deer are everywhere. I think probably in Wisconsin, your listeners are seeing white-tailed deer all the time. But that would just be a population that is added into the overall health that's reflected in the LPI. And so it's a way to really try to distill these trends in a meaningful way, in a way that can inform us about how we're doing in terms of taking care of the other species on Earth.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the worldwide decline in wildlife populations. We have Jeff Opperman, who's a freshwater scientist for the World Wildlife Fund. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I wonder, Jeff, then, as you look at this as an index fund, a stock index fund, you know, there are so many market forces. One of those would be the warming climate. What impact does the climate crisis have on these wildlife that you monitor?
So, big picture, one thing that the report emphasizes is that the climate crisis and the nature crisis are two sides of the same coin. So many of the drivers of the trends that are causing problems in one are causing challenges and problems in the other. And many of the solutions that we have to address one can also address the other. So we really have to solve them together. A great example would be tropical forests. So tropical forests have seen some of the most severe declines in deforestation over recent years. Tropical forests also host the most species and populations of animals of among ecosystem types. And they store an immense amount of carbon that stores carbon to keep it out of the atmosphere. And when they are cleared or burned, that carbon goes right back in the atmosphere. And all the wildlife populations that live in that forested area are negatively impacted. So that's just one example of how those challenges are so intertwined. And somewhat alarmingly, climate change thus far is not a major reason that wildlife populations have declined. There are many other drivers, particularly habitat loss and conversion of land, pollution, overharvesting, hunting, you know, all the ones that you might think of. And climate change has really only just begun to be felt. But when we look forward, scientists are now showing that if we do not meet the climate target that has been set of 2 degrees, or even more hopefully holding warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, that is, if we don't hit those targets, the climate change will fairly quickly become a leading driver of the decline of populations, of extinctions of species. So it looms quite large on the horizon as something that's not just affecting us in terms of increased floods or increased forest fires or heat stress and declining water and all those serious challenges of climate change. Mm-hmm. It's going to just be adding to the loss of wildlife if we cannot meet our climate targets.
You mentioned deforestation, and you know that is one of the key threats to biodiversity, which is identified in the report. There's the agriculture, the hunting, the logging, the pollution, invasive species, and climate change. And here in Wisconsin, we have connections with all those things, of course, particularly though agriculture and forestry industries are huge drivers of our economy. How do we think of these threats in relation to economic vitality?
Well, that's a great question, and it is truly a challenge, because if we look into the past, we know that the widespread clearing of forests, we always talk about the Amazon and how the Amazon is being cleared. Mm-hmm. Well, the Eastern and Midwestern and Great Lakes United States was a vast Amazon-like forest, not tropical, but a vast unbroken carpet of green. That old adage that a squirrel could run from Massachusetts to Minnesota without touching the ground may or may not have been true, but you get the picture. And so we know that that conversion of forests for timber harvesting and for agriculture was a primary driver of the loss of species and the decline of populations. But as you also just mentioned, they are the bedrock of economies. But what's, I suppose, a reason for excitement and optimism is that we have learned so much about how to move food production towards away from being a nature negative and towards being a nature positive, and how to harvest timber in more sustainable ways. So we're not talking about, you know, switching Wisconsin back to being entirely forest. What we're talking about is managing what Wisconsin and other states have, managing the legacy of forests and open space that they have for the multiple benefits for people, recreation, wildlife, and managing agriculture in ways that will, you know, produce abundant, healthy food, but won't be degrading nature. And, you know, in the Great Lakes states, we really do think about how agricultural practices can contribute to the degradation of the water quality of the Great Lakes, which is an immense value and resource for the people of Wisconsin and other states. And so I think that underscores why we need to be moving agriculture into this more of a nature positive way of producing food, but we know how to do it. And that's what's exciting.
And we're going to look closer more in your area of freshwater. World Wildlife Fund lead scientist for global freshwater, Jeff Opperman, with us unpacking the WWF's new report tracking the health of the planet that seeks to understand how animal populations are changing over time. Join in on the Living Planet Report, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On this 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, we take stock of the Living Planet Report from the World Wildlife Fund that confirms the planet is in the midst of a biodiversity and climate crisis and that we have a last chance to act, but it's going to take more than conservation. Jeff Opperman is global lead scientist for freshwater at the World Wildlife Fund and stays with us. Let's go to Gary in Boscobel. Gary, what would you like to bring up?
Well, I've been doing prairie conservation here in Wisconsin since about 1974. And the concern about loss of biodiversity is one of the things that plays on my mind every single day, because I still go out and do prairie restoration work on sites that an organization that I founded, the Prairie Enthusiasts, own and manage. And there's, after doing this for so many years, there's subtle things that are going on that are unexplainable. And on all of our sites are basically Noah's Ark of biodiversity on these tall grass prairie remnants. And we have no idea what insect species are there. And we have no idea how those insect species interact with the native plants that are there. And we have no idea about what that does to the microscopic flora and fauna in the soil. So we're just shooting from the hip all the time. And I'm afraid that we're going to lose more and more biodiversity that we don't even know that we had. Mm. We don't have people that are monitoring these sites and doing insect identification. And even if we knew what was there, we don't know how to manage these sites.
Gary, thank you. I just want Jeff to jump in here. Such interesting words there. A Noah's Ark of biodiversity in the tall grass prairie land, but we don't know what we have.
Yeah, well, just thanks to Gary for his question and for being one of the people who's out there, actually working on the ground to try to restore nature. It's incredibly important. And he raises this really fascinating and alarming question about insect decline, which the Living Planet Index that we've been talking about is about vertebrates. So that's, animals with backbones, mammals, birds, reptiles, fish, amphibians. It's not insects. And there have been very alarming reports in various scientific publications recently showing that there probably has been, or there is currently, a major decline in insects around the world. So I do believe that the Living Planet, the scientists who manage the Living Planet Index are collecting information on invertebrates and such as insects and trying to bring that in to paint a bigger picture. The vertebrates are what we see and what we think about. We think about tigers, we think about bald eagles and all that. But the invertebrates are the vast majority of species, and they're doing an immense amount of that work. When we talk about ecosystems providing us with healthy soil and clean water, it's invertebrates or even all the way down to fungi and bacteria that are doing so much of the processing of soil and water and soil health and all of that. And they are declining, and we're not really sure. We don't even know all the species. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge challenge that we need a lot more science to understand what we have and what we're losing and how to respond to it.
Why can't the scientists, dozens of scientists who are involved in this report, why can't they look at all wildlife to give a more complete picture?
Meaning including insects?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I think it's For one thing, it's a massive amount of data that they are already collecting and organizing. So they are working with 32,000 data sets of different populations. So, you know, like the river dolphins in a specific part of Brazil, or as I mentioned, the whale sharks of the Caribbean, those kind of, or the bald eagles of the Great Lakes. So they're working with data sets, 32,000 of those representing some 5,000 species. It's already an immense data set to try to integrate in a meaningful way to look at trends over the 50 years that we're talking about here. And I do think that, and even among vertebrates, there's a lot of gaps. So we have a lot more data sets from North America and Europe than we do from Africa or South America. So they try to account for that. They try to balance the fact that we are oversampling some areas and undersampling others. They try to adjust for that. But we have a generally good understanding of vertebrates because they're big. We can see them. People are interested in them. There's more funding for them. They're related to fisheries or hunting or other economic activities. A lot of people are very into watching, you know, bird watching. So there's just a lot of support. Whereas the data for insects are dramatically incomplete. So they would have a huge challenge of trying to collate data that would be representative of insects because it's the gaps are so, you know, with the vertebrates, they're trying to fill in gaps. I think with insects, it would be mostly gaps.
Wow, lots to fill in there. Talking about the decline of vertebrates around the world, we have Jeff Opperman, a freshwater scientist for the World Wildlife Fund. Jeff, you're an expert in freshwater biology, and the report says freshwater species declined by an average 83% since 1970. Which species in particular are struggling?
So, yeah, that result, the headline result is a very concerning one, because the decline in freshwater is about twice the rate of decline of terrestrial or oceans, land or oceans. And so it's showing that our freshwater systems, in terms of their ability to support species and populations and, you know, healthy, abundant populations, has greatly diminished over time. A few of the key contributors to why that's declining, for example, migratory fish on their own have declined about 76%. So they're, you know, right about in line with that overall number. And there are a lot of migratory fish. So they are a big chunk of the total. So that they're affecting that total. And migratory fish are particularly vulnerable because they move across many different habitats to do that migration. And the classic one that most people think about is salmon, who emerge as juvenile fish. They're born in streams, you know, often high up in the mountains of the Pacific coast. They might spend a year or two in streams, and then as they mature, they swim out the river systems and out to the ocean, and then they grow very large with all the productivity out in the oceans as they feed for 3 to 5 years and then come back.
They find their way back home miraculously.
They're able to track their what's called their natal stream, so where they're born, by the chemical signature of that, by just smelling it in the water as they move. But you can imagine all the different things that could affect a migratory fish along the way, from dams to timber harvest to overfishing to pollution to anything that's happening out in the oceans or that's happening in the rivers. So migratory fish face a lot of challenges, and they're one of the big reasons that the freshwater overall index is declining.
The report incorporates knowledge and leadership of indigenous communities into conservation efforts. What could this accomplish?
So, for one thing, there's just the issues of when we think about conservation, we think about how do we manage land for the benefit of species, and that's what people think about. When they think about conservation, we think about national parks and protecting, let's protect the grizzly bear in a national park. But much of the surface of the world is still owned and managed by indigenous people. So the people that were originally there, and it's their land. And that land actually is generally managed in ways that are consistent with conservation. So they're not designated as national parks, and they're being managed by indigenous people, but they often manage it in ways that are consistent with protecting forests and protecting what lives in the forests. And people who have done satellite studies looking down on the Amazon, generally, and much of the Amazon is owned by indigenous people, and there's much less deforestation in the areas owned by indigenous people than there is outside of it.
Let's pause right there. Jeff Opperman explaining WWF's new Living Planet report. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The world's wildlife populations have suffered a devastating decline, as outlined in the new Living Planet Index charting the species population changes. Jeff Opperman is global freshwater lead scientist for the World Wildlife Fund, who has worked on three of the Living Planet reports, stays with us. Let's take another call now. Chris is with us from Port Wing. Chris, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. Thanks for the great show and the great guest. I wanted to point out that it's an election season and we can vote for conservation-oriented candidates, and you can look at that more on the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters sites. They rate candidates. So I called to say that there's a tremendous book by the premier entomologist E.O. Wilson on this subject called Half Earth, where he advocates for reserving half of the earth for wildlife and native species. And the issue of economic activity being declined by conservation is really a red herring, because what we do is we incentivize good activities and they become good jobs, and we can reduce the damaging activities and get rid of the bad jobs. We need a climate plus economy. We need a nature plus economy. And it's all based on the choices we make, the winners and the losers we pick with our elected officials.
Well, Chris, I just want Jeff to be able to jump in here on the idea of a nature plus and climate plus economy. Jeff, go ahead.
So that's a great point in that, when we think about how do we reverse these trends, we've been calling it bend the curve, because if you look at the Living Planet Index, it's this long decline. And what we're really trying to do is to stop the decline and then reverse it. So we want to bend the curve back upwards. We want there to be more nature, more healthy ecosystems, more abundant populations by 2030, 2040, 2050 going forward. And that's going to take a lot more than conservation. So conservation organizations can only do part of this. And in fact, it's a relatively small part. We are working hard at some very specific things, and then we are really encouraging governments and corporations to begin to move their activities, to align their activities with what the caller just brought up about a nature positive economy. And it's going to take a whole of society approach to address these challenges. It's not just what conservation organizations can do. We are trying to point out the issues. We are trying to show a roadmap of where we need to go, but it's going to take a whole of society response and also in many ways that are beneficial to the economy. And there's nothing, there's probably no better example than renewable energy technologies and what those have done in the past couple decades.
On that note, let's go to Matt in Green Bay. Matt, hi, go ahead.
Hello, good morning, everybody. Undecided voter here, so this is a really interesting topic, climate change in general. Basically, my question is, I don't know if this is even relevant to the guests, but how exactly would we stop climate from changing specifically? And I know one of the ways is solar geoengineering. And That I am not for personally. I don't think it would have a good impact on the nature. And personally, I like the sun. And I know that's one way to stop climate from warming is solar geoengineering. Could your guest talk anything about that? And
Matt, thank you. Yes, Matt, bringing up wind, solar, geothermal, what implications would that have on what you've studied here about wildlife?
Sure. Well, just real quick, the caller was referencing geoengineering, such as putting aerosols up in the atmosphere to deflect some of the sun's rays.
It's
a very controversial topic. And people would look at it as kind of perhaps a last ditch effort. And it's a very difficult conversation. I mean, it's very difficult to talk about and it's uncertain. So that's why I think let's just focus on what is certain. We know how to address climate change. We know how to dramatically lower emissions. There's a blueprint out there. We need to move most energy towards electricity. So, our cars, they need to become electric vehicles. Our homes, rather than burning natural gas for heat, they need to have heat pumps that run on electricity. And then we need that electricity to come from renewable sources or from grids that are largely renewable. And of course, grids are complicated things and they need lots of different generation. And we certainly know that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow, but modern grids have a diverse set of generation, storage, transmission, and demand management that are increasingly allowing grids to be dominated by renewables. So we have a blueprint of what to do. And so I think we need to just follow that blueprint as fast and as much as we can. That will have dramatic improvements for wildlife. This is going back to what we talked about at the very beginning. These are two sides of one coin. Much of what we're doing that is unsustainable is contributing to the climate crisis. It's also contributing to the nature and biodiversity crisis. And if we begin to address one, very often we'll be addressing the other. Just as a quick example, I'll reprise, but protecting existing forests and restoring forests where forests used to be are great ways to try to reduce carbon in the atmosphere. The most important thing to do is to lower emissions rapidly, but forests have an important role to play, and other ecosystems, peatlands, mangroves, a lot of these ecosystems can suck carbon out of the air, and we protect those. We're helping with the climate challenge, and we're helping with the nature crisis as well.
We're talking about the decline of vertebrates around the world and this report by the World Wildlife Fund with Jeff Opperman, a freshwater scientist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff, the effects of climate change, as we've been talking about, are just beginning to be felt. Are you worried that we'll see an even greater decline in wildlife populations as climate change becomes more pronounced and really ramps up?
Yes, I was mentioning this earlier, but scientists are forecasting that climate change itself could become one of the primary threats. It's only just begun. I think I'm forgetting the name, but there's really one species so far that's gone extinct. I think it might have been a small mammal that lived on an island that essentially the island was just above sea level and it became flooded with rising sea levels. But that's one example. But in the future, let's say 20, 30 years, if we don't hit these climate targets, just here's one example. I mean, coral reefs have already been hit very hard by warming oceans and other factors associated with warming oceans. Scientists forecast that if we exceed that 2 degree target, we'll lose almost all corals. Mm. It's a stunning to contemplate that. If we can hold warming to 1.5 degrees, and some people might say 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees, one thing to remember is those are Celsius. I wish I could quickly translate them to Fahrenheit, but it's a bigger shift in temperature if you were thinking Fahrenheit. But the difference between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees, with 2 degrees, we'll probably lose most corals around the world. At 1.5 degrees, a third of them might still be around. That's still a very dramatic loss, but that is considerably better, and it's a much better foundation to start thinking about restoration of corals as corals themselves are evolving to deal with warmer waters, as we can select corals that are better with warmer waters and propagate them and try to restore coral reefs. It just gives us a fighting chance. Hmm. So there's a huge difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees in terms of where we're going to be at the end of the century. And so it just really underscores that if not just for our own sake, in terms of floods and water scarcity, but this nature crisis also is inextricably linked with our success at managing climate change.
Let's bring in Michael now in Spring Green. Michael, hi, what are your thoughts?
Hi, first of all, I wanted to thank Jeff for the important work he's doing. But I just wanted to bring up this term climate change, which I think is a kind of a misnomer and one that creates confusion. If you look at the geologic history of the Earth, climate change has been consistent. For example, Wisconsin used to be a subtropical environment. I'm wondering if there are other terms that we could use, like climate degradation or threat, or I did hear Jeff mention climate challenge. Mm. Anyway, I was wondering, Jeff, if you could maybe address the problems with this term. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, a lot. We certainly do think about the communications, because communications is essential. It's how information is conveyed to different people and in ways that make them think that it's worth acting. So science is super important, but until science is communicated, it doesn't really have an effect. So the communications angle is super important. You're mentioning, do these phrases resonate? And that is certainly worthy of research and focus group and testing and all of that. I remember the columnist, Thomas Friedman, he thought that global warming was a bad term because, you know, in some places there's going to be shifts that result in colder, mm-hmm. like the polar vortex will be more likely to come down and hit the Great Lakes states with Arctic temperatures, in part because of an overall warming, but it releases cold air from the Arctic in the winter. So people think, wow, a colder winter is part of global warming? That doesn't make sense. So he suggested we call it global weirding. Weird, like I'm not sure if that word came, but becoming more weird. And that really, so many things are out of our memory. Even as I said, I'm 51 years old. I can remember a distinctly different climate when I was mm-hmm. a kid. Mm-hmm. And I bet your listeners too, because the changes in the northern latitudes have been even more dramatic about what? How often do you have, you know, snow in the winter and when does it start and when does it end?
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us and explaining the report.
Great. Well, thank you very much for this opportunity and the great calls and the great questions. I really appreciate it. And I hope people come away understanding that there's an awful lot that we know we can do and that we can do to reverse this.
Jeff Opperman, Global Freshwater Lead Scientist at the World Wildlife Fund. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 3 weeks until the November general election, we focus in on the U.S. Senate contest. Democratic Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes seeks to unseat incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. We plan to talk with Senator Johnson Thursday after 8:30. Join in with your questions for Mandela Barnes, 800-642-1234. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be here. Thank you for taking the time.
So, yes, starting with inflation, the latest Marquette Law School poll finds that it is the top concern among registered voters here in Wisconsin, elsewhere in the country as well. 68% of respondents said they are very concerned. If you're elected senator, what would you do to address inflation?
And people should be concerned because they've been left behind. That's why we started out this campaign with the plan to rebuild the middle class. That's what it's been about since day one. The reality is Ron Johnson has continued to leave working families behind. Now, we know what we need to do. We first need to give working class families some relief, and that's why I support a middle class tax cut, not a tax cut that goes to the most wealthy individuals like what Senator Johnson has supported. And also, we should expand earned income tax credit and make the child tax credit permanent. And we also have to hold oil and drug company executives accountable for using inflation as a smokescreen to jack up prices on consumers. These are companies that are making record profits right now. And they're also charging people record amounts of money for basic necessities. It's an unfair advantage, and it only happens because we have too many leaders like Ron Johnson in office who not only support this action, they're getting campaign support from pharmaceutical industry, from oil and gas industry, and working people are paying the price. We also need to build more things right here in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, Senator Johnson thinks we have enough jobs, and it ignores the economic reality. It ignores people's economic experience in this country. When we had the chance to build those next generation postal vehicles right here in Oshkosh, and they decided to move them to South Carolina, Ron Johnson said, we have enough jobs. He's been all too comfortable sending good jobs out of state or overseas.
Well, I want to pause there because Republicans have pointed to the pandemic aid to Americans as the driving factor behind the rapidly rising prices we're dealing with on food, on rent, on our daily staples in our lives. Did the Democratic economic stimulus spending accelerate inflation as we see it today?
Well, unfortunately, they are going to point fingers. And the reality is you could just look at the record profits that these companies are making, oil and gas industry making more money than they've ever made before. And at the same time, they're charging people more money than they've ever charged before. It's not hard to go from point A to point B here. And it's unfortunate that Republicans would rather lay blame on the small business owners, the family farmers, and the working people who were on the brink of catastrophe during the course of the pandemic, instead of the people who are making money hand over fist. Over the course of this pandemic, billionaire wealth increased an additional $1.5 trillion, and 7 million people found themselves in poverty for the first time. So we know exactly where the blame lies, and we know who the politicians are, like Ron Johnson, that make it harder for working people to get the fair shot they deserve.
Well, the Senate, a 50-50, where the flipping of a single seat in the Senate would deliver a Republican majority. How would you, as a junior senator, get members of Congress to coalesce around the issues you care about that you're talking about? How would you go about, you know, easing the dysfunction we see in Congress?
Well, I'm happy to work with anybody that's ready to work for Wisconsin. Now, the reality is we don't have enough people who are ready to do the work that needs to be done. Let's take the CHIPS Act as an example, which is going to breathe new life into manufacturing in this country. And Wisconsin certainly has an opportunity to benefit from the CHIPS Act. 16 Republican senators voted for it, 47 Democrats. Ron Johnson voted against it because he'd rather play politics than do the right thing to create jobs right here in Wisconsin. As a member of the Assembly, I worked across the aisle to lower the cost of chemotherapy drugs, as an example. And as Lieutenant Governor, I've been fortunate to be able to travel the entire state. And when I show up in districts, legislative districts around Wisconsin, we make sure to send out the alert to the legislators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. I've done many visits with healthcare leaders, with county health officers, with Republican legislators. I've even done farm visits with Republican legislators. It's about doing the right thing for Wisconsin, actually listening to the people on the ground instead of the politician.
Well, let's listen to one person here on the ground. Maddie is with us from De Pere. Maddie, what would you like to bring up?
Yes, I'd like to give you this opportunity to explain yourself with regard to defund the police. I do want the police to behave better than they do sometimes, but we all know we need the police. Also, with regard to ICE, I get these campaigns from the cards from the opposition saying you want to eliminate ICE, and I'd like to give you opportunity to explain yourself more clearly.
Okay, Maddie, thank you. ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Maddie, for the question. And I really appreciate the time to clarify this here because I'll tell you, Ron Johnson and his allies are lying. I do not support defunding the police, and I don't support abolishing ICE. I support making sure law enforcement has the resources they need. also making sure we do exactly what it takes to prevent crime from happening in the first place. It was a moment we had in the debate where Senator Johnson just doesn't seem to understand that good paying jobs and quality schools help stop the flow of crime. They help give people opportunities that would, you know, with the lack of opportunities, people turn to some very dark and desperate places. When my granddad moved to Milwaukee after World War II, he got a union job as a steel worker. He had a good job in a safe city. Unfortunately, when factories like that close their doors, ship the jobs overseas, is when we saw a rise in crime and violence. Things can be better because they have been better. And when we build more trust and cooperation with law enforcement and communities, it makes police officers' jobs easier.
Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, thank you. I was going to say a PolitiFact report from September 10th on if Scott Walker released anybody out on parole during his administration also included that in Walker's time, 81% of people out on parole either broke parole or committed a new crime. Under the Evers administration, that went down to 16%. So is it fair to blame Democrats, including the administration Lieutenant Governor Barnes is part of, for an over 50% reduction in the likelihood people on parole would break it and commit a new crime? Also, Mr. Johnson's been part of filibustering a lot of bills, from banning gerrymandering to
And Nate, we're short on time. I'm going to let Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes respond.
Hey, Nate, I really appreciate your clarification on that. And I really appreciate you checking out the PolitiFact. And I hope you'll share that with as many people as possible, because they are trying to mislead Johnson's campaign. His allies are trying to fearmonger. They just want to make you afraid. That's what it comes down to. And it's also hypocritical. And I'm glad that Charles Benson in the debate brought up the First Step Act, because Ron Johnson voted to release 2,000 to 3,000 people early, 2,000 to 3,000 federally incarcerated individuals. So for him to try to point the finger back at me shows exactly who he is. It shows that he's a person that will, you know, he'll do whatever. But if anybody else does it, he tries to make a big fuss about it. And is trying to politicize this issue, and he's only making people and communities less safe.
And we'll have to leave it there. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much.
Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate seat, and our show offered both candidates equal airtime this week, by the way, to discuss their campaigns. The lieutenant governor accepted a shorter time window than offered. Thursday, we'll speak to incumbent Ron Johnson about the race. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.